Film appreciation can be a group effort. 90% of a standing ovation is audience members feeling they have to stand up because their neighbors already did. But if you are a professional film critic, does your responsibility lie with the audience? Or are you called to a deeper task when that comes with the responsibility of saving a public from its own base whims? Now, imagine you are the film critic for the New York Times, the paper of record, and you are at an international film festival watching a new movie made by a creative team from your home country. You are desperately hoping it will make a good impression on the world's cinematic stage, and it's horrible, crass, violent, seemingly supposed to be humorous and light, but it's not. It's just pointless and grim, and yet everyone in the theater seems to love it. Is this the final nail in the coffin of American screen artistry? This was the question afflicting New York Times' legendary critic, Bosley Crowther, in 1967 at the Montreal Expo Film Festival, while watching Arthur Penn's Bonnie and Clyde, and the audience around him seemed to be completely on the side of its murderous, idiotic protagonists, and this made Crowther's hatred of the piece take on the character of a deeply necessary social critique. His distaste and need to destroy the film felt oddly personal. Within a month, Crowther had written multiple hit pieces, some short dispatches from Expo 67, and then, ultimately, his official pan about how Bonnie and Clyde ruined the entire festival for him. Unfortunately for Crowther, his was not the only critical opinion. Shortly after he published his multiple objectives, Joe Morgenstern, the reviewer for Newsweek, panned the film as well. His take was largely in line with Crowther's. He had caught a showing at Warner Brothers' Fifth Avenue screening room and was unnerved, having been seated right in front of the film's handsome star-slash-producer, Warren Beatty. Morgenstern thought the movie was slight, gross, and trashy, calling it a squalid shoot-'em-up. He turned in the negative piece and went home, and yet for some reason, he was compelled to take his wife to see the film for a second time. And the audience reacted as riotously as had Crowther's in Montreal. However, unlike Crowther, who perceived the fun the audience was having as part and parcel with a society in sharp moral decline, Morgenstern instantly recognized that he was in a new era, that the film did reflect current society, not a social order in decline, rather, one ready, finally, to depict disturbing truths America hadn't been able to accept until now. It was too late to pull his earlier negative piece, but perhaps a second review, a mea culpa fully admitting his wrongness, would be an even stronger statement in and of itself. At dinner, a few days later after the first piece had come out, but before the famous reversal was scheduled to, he confessed to a colleague about how wrong his initial impression had been. This colleague, a critic for the New Republic, just finishing up her own six-page rave of the film, agreed, slyly adding, "You really missed the boat on that one." This third critic was, of course, Pauline Kael. Far from missing the boat on this one, her subsequent essay on Bonnie and Clyde would almost single-handedly set her own career, as well as the future of the business itself, sailing into previously unimagined horizons.
Welcome to Kael Your Idols, a new Hollywood podcast with your hosts, Sam Ludwig and Elena Gibson.
All right. So, you know, I opened talking about the critics. We're talking about a very famous movie, and a very important movie to our podcast.
Yeah. In some ways, it feels weirdly like cliche doing an episode on this, because it's if you talk about new Hollywood, you have to talk about this movie.
Yeah.
So it almost feels like what do we say? What do we bring
that's
new and interesting? But it's like a hard thing to balance, right? Because we might have some listeners who haven't read anything about Bonnie and Clyde.
Exactly, right.
So that's like, you know, a needle that we're trying to thread. Not trying to, you know, trying to bring something new to the discussion, but still making sure that we impart the important context that this film has on launching new Hollywood cinema.
This would be like writing about the American Revolution without discussing Lexington and Concord or something like that.
Oh, everybody knows about that.
Yes, sir. Maybe George Washington? I don't know. You know what
Sam
I mean?
Likes history.
Yeah, fine. Yeah.
I don't.
Right. Well, a podcast about a historical time period.
Film is different. That's about my only way of having any context for history at all. I didn't have a sense of knowledge of dates. Like, I didn't even know, like, what years World War II happened.
Yeah.
Until I started watching movies and becoming a film buff. And that cinema and the history of cinema really gave me a timeline of history.
Yeah, I think, you know, my interest in theater did a similar thing. So, but this is a movie that not only is this basically the widely recognized first real important work in the cinematic movement that came to be called New Hollywood, it also just happens to contain so many elements that typify New Hollywood, but almost more than that, it's got like 6 or 7 major figures in the same movie. Like people who will all themselves go on to branch out into different areas and all, you know, be amongst the first names that you would mention when you're talking about New Hollywood. Warren Beatty, Arthur Penn, Gene Hackman, Faye Dunaway, Gene Wilder, Benton and Newman, the screenwriters.
Is Gene Wilder a New Hollywood person?
Absolutely.
Really? Okay, I love Gene Wilder, but I guess yeah. I haven't seen him in New Hollywood stuff.
When Gene Wilder is in this movie, you don't notice, I mean, his acting style is totally different than anything else that any of them are doing.
Oh, I know.
But that's what I'm saying. He's got this weird realism to him. That's always been what's so amazing about his comic things is you're seeing such a more relatable vision of, he's caricaturing a certain, it's hard to describe Gene Wilder. I mean, like, what is Gene Wilder's bit? Like,
it's so weird. Okay, so I love Gene Wilder. I'm, like, so sexually attracted to him.
And he is fully formed in this movie.
And it's so weird because this is his debut.
Yeah.
Like, feature debut. And it's weird because it's, like, his role is as if the filmmakers already knew, like, oh, Gene Wilder's great. Yeah. It'll be fun.
What if they just hang out with Gene Wilder?
Right, it's like they cast a star in the small scene.
Right.
But, like, he wasn't a star at that time, unless he was famous for some other reason.
No, he is, in the time of the making of this film, he has met Mel Brooks, and Mel Brooks has said, oh, I'm making this movie, the producers, do you want to read for it? He reads for Leo Bloom, doesn't hear for Mel Brooks for a couple of years or something like that, right?
Is the producers
a
new Hollywood film?
I would say so. Mel Brooks is definitely
don't think of Mel Brooks movies as new.
Well,
Hollywood.
Comedy is kind of not very new Hollywood-y.
Yeah,
yeah. I mean, okay, yeah, comedy does exist apart from film in so many ways. You know,
yeah.
it never really gets the recognition it's due.
Yeah.
At the same time, though, you know, I do think that you can look at Mel Brooks's comedies as being kind of pretty different from the comedies that you'd see in the earlier 60s and 50s.
Sure.
And stuff.
Plenty
you know.
Of satire.
Right, plenty of satire, and it's different. Like his whole parody thing, like, I mean, I guess, like,
but it doesn't feel in the same spirit as the rest of New Hollywood.
Blazing Saddles?
Yeah, Blazing Saddles.
Blazing Saddles feels pretty fucking New Hollywood to me.
Yeah, I guess so.
Young Frankenstein was Gene Wilder's idea. So
right.
Gene Wilder is himself, you know, it's interesting. Sorry, we're just starting off talking about Gene Wilder, which is fine.
I love him, so he deserves it.
And perhaps, you know, you could say we're starting from the bottom up. Like, maybe,
yeah.
you know, like because he has this small role, aces it.
Oh, he knocks out of the park.
Yeah, it's amazing. He's so good. You know,
best acting in the movie?
Best acting in the movie, probably. I think this movie has great performances, but the acting in it is... It's really good acting... Yeah, you want to just talk about the...
Yeah, I'm curious what you think, because I wrote down in my notes, great acting. And then later I was, like, wondering, is it good acting? So Pauline Kael loves Gene Hackman's acting. She thinks that Gene Hackman did an amazing job.
I think he's great
the best performance in the movie.
She didn't
really love... She did not love Faye Dunaway's acting in it, but she also thought that the Bonnie character wasn't fully formed, so she didn't have much to work with.
I don't know about that.
Yeah, I don't know. But that's what she thinks.
Yeah, yeah.
And she thought, you know... Warren Beatty, like, is not really an actor. Like, his, like, body movements weren't very actor-like, but he still had that, like, Beatty charm.
And, yeah.
You know, that slyness that worked with Clyde. And, you know, she has a long essay where she talks... So maybe I'm, like, summarizing this all up a little too nicely. Sometimes, like,
yeah.
Pauline Kael can be very vague in, like, what she actually thinks about something, right. Which is one of the, I don't know, it's really fun reading her.
Well, she's making film art. Essays. She's making art herself.
Yeah, yeah. You guys should totally criticism. Read her yeah. film essays. Like, her one on Bonnie and Clyde is very long, but really great.
Just the idea that writer. The New Republic published 6 pages of film criticism. Do they even have film critics at this point? I don't read the New Republic. My stepmom, to be fair, used to work for the New Republic. Sorry, Becky, I never read the New Republic. but I think of them as more of a political thing, but I guess they must have. I never read the New Republic, okay?
Okay.
It's the in-flight magazine on
We forgive you.
Air Flight One.
I never even knew it existed, right, so... Well,
I'm sorry. Okay, but Beatty, or Faye Dunaway...
Just the acting in general.
Okay, so yes, the acting in general. This movie opens... The opening scene...
I hate their accents.
No, but that's what I was going to say, though. Their acting in that scene is so over the top.
Yeah.
And it's kind of great, but
It's distracting.
They kind of drop that by a certain point in the movie, which is probably good.
Yes.
But I like that they... Like, so... Okay, so here's one thing. So one of my favorite things, I've on the record as saying this, one of my favorite things about New Hollywood is that we get to see weird-looking people and normal-looking people. And this movie is populated with a lot of that. You got Gene Hackman, Estelle Parsons, Gene Wilder. These are weird, regular-looking people.
Yeah, but all the farmers and stuff.
All the farmers and stuff. Very, very odd, idiosyncratic. Yeah,
Bonnie's mother is actually just somebody who was, like, a school teacher who was there while they were filming.
She looks amazing.
And they were like, you gotta be her mother.
And they were right.
Yeah.
But... Faye Dunaway and Warren Beatty, glamorous. Two incredibly beautiful people. Some of the most beautiful people you've ever seen in a movie.
Yeah.
But I love that they're making them look weird and wacky in that opening scene. Like, I love that they're being like, hey, what's up? Mama? You know, it's a little fun and incongruous to see how over the top and goofy their acting is in that, even though they're these, like, pretty people. Does this make sense?
No, yeah, it's weird because, like, the first shot of Faye Dunaway, she's, like, naked, right? And she's super sexy, obviously. But then she just goes, like, clambering down the stairs.
The shot of her feet as if she's wearing giant wooden shoes.
Yeah, and you're just like, it's like a crotch shot, but you just see these, like, knees and feet, and it's just very unflattering.
Yeah,
it's kind of shocking the way they decided to have that shot in the movie.
And that's what I like about the opening, is they go for this maximum, like, these are two hot movie stars, but... These are not cool gangsters.
They are cool, though.
No, yeah, you're right. They're cool and they're very fashionable, but they're not, like...
They're hicks.
They're hicks, exactly. You're right. And the movie is portraying them not as you're sort of like, hey, I'm a gangster, see? But they're like, hey, I'm gonna rob a bank.
Yeah.
And you're my woman, but I'm not gonna have sex with you. Which is so interesting, too. And so, that opening scene establishes an acting style, I think, with them... That does not quite carry on through the rest of the film.
No, because I was so annoyed by their accents, and I'm like, I don't know how I'm going to handle it throughout the whole movie. And then I just stopped noticing it because they stopped doing it.
They stopped doing it. Faye Dunaway is a controversial actor. You know, a lot of people kind of have issues with her. I think she's great.
I liked her.
Would I give her a super complicated role where I was trying to sympathize with her or where I expected her to show a variety of different sides? Not necessarily. I think that she is somebody who... Like, I can't imagine Faye Dunaway ever saying anything truly, like funny. You know what I mean? Or, like... really charming. Like, this movie uses her weird kind of lack of charm in a way.
But she pulls off the emotional swings of Bonnie. Bonnie's just, like, so happy-go-lucky throughout it until she starts getting annoyed at Blanche, and then she, you know, becomes really, like, kind of down. They pick up Gene Wilder and his girlfriend, and then he says that he's an undertaker, and Bonnie reacts very strongly to that and kicks him out.
Yeah.
And it's like... It's this premonition of their death.
Yes.
And then immediately after that, she is running away from the group and Clyde, you know, catches up with her and she's like, I gotta see my mom. And they go to see her mom and it's this like weird, dreamy like scene where they're having a picnic with the mom and people from her hometown, but everybody's wearing black as if they're kind of like all having a funeral for Bonnie and Clyde. With Bonnie and Clyde being there.
The trippiness of that scene is, you're totally right. Like it has this weird thing where it kind of does evoke that feeling of being around family.
Yeah.
Where you're like, oh, this feels so nice. But then you kind of like are lingering and you're like glazed over. Do they know me at all? What is this? Yeah. Like, who is this person that I've never seen before? Yeah. Like,
that scene was so sad.
It's so sad. And that is a real tonal shift, right?
Yeah.
But sorry, just to really quick go back to the Gene Wilder scene and like her, the Undertaker thing. What I love about that, and so this movie famously, I think people were ready to project a lot onto this film. As I said in the beginning, you know, Crowther at the New York Times was projecting like, oh my God, this is going to destroy, you know, the fabric of society. Mm. We have to stop this. Mm. This is only, you know, the morality of movies has been getting worse and worse. And just imagine where it's going to go from here. I mean, this is, so we have to stop this. But it's not a stretch to see proto-hippies and countercultural people watching this movie and totally seeing themselves in these figures. It's blatantly there. These figures are depicted as folk heroes who are anti-establishment, pro-poor people. It's a movie about finding your tribe, like finding your group of people.
Gathering your gang.
Getting your family. Like
It's family-oriented.
Exactly. It's family-oriented and relationship-oriented. Yeah. Bonnie and Clyde have an odd relationship. He is sexually impotent, but they love each other. It's frustrating. They talk about it.
Yeah.
They talk about their feelings.
Yeah.
They are not dishonest with themselves. Like, they are not, you know, living in some false reality. They actually know what's going on in their life, and they don't hide from it, and they don't hide from it with each other. And so what I love about that scene with Wilder and, what's her name? She had a weird, what's the actress's name?
Evans, right,
yeah. So basically, it's like, they're these normies, right? And then they get sucked into this scene with these, like, hippies, right? Sort of. And so the hippies are like, why don't you come hang out with us? And they're, like, really freaked out by the hippies. And then gradually, they start dipping a toe into, like, the fantasy of, what if I did join the Barrow Gang and stuff like that? And then they give they explain reality to the hippies. And the hippies are then freaked out by the normies.
Death.
But just reality. The hippies freak out the normies, and then the normies freak out the hippies.
Mm.
This stuff was very pointedly put into the script. This was a script that was designed consciously as a quote-unquote French New Wave movie.
Yeah.
That was what Benton and Newman explicitly said they wanted to do.
Yeah. They tried to get... They first wanted Truffaut to direct it.
Who would have been horrible. In my opinion, he could never have made this movie.
Yeah, and then Godard.
Who also would have been fucking horrible. He had a whole thing where, and this is so Godard, you know, he was like, oh, let's film it in New York and New Jersey and stuff like that. Like,
In January.
And they're like, no, this is like, they're in Texas, it's warm, this story, like, this takes place in the American South. And he's like, I'm talking about cinema, you're talking about weather. And it's like...
And then he said, goodbye.
Goodbye. And it's like, that's a part of... making a movie.
Right.
It's like,
you
knowing
have to
what,
consider the weather.
Knowing what are you talking about, man? And so, and then he like saw the movie and he was like, he sent them a telegram that was like, let's remake it now. And I'm sure they were just like, no, thank you. Because by that point, Godard is like already burnt out.
Yeah. But then Warren Beatty went to Europe and met with Truffaut and heard about the script from Truffaut. And so then Beatty bought the rights and decided like, this should be an American director who makes it. So he shopped around for a bit for directors. He had, like, Arthur Penn turned it down multiple times.
Right.
And eventually he convinced Arthur Penn to help make it. And I think one of the things that helped convince him was that he would get 10% of the profits.
Yes. Well, Beatty we have to talk about, okay? Beatty is, in many ways, the central part of this movie.
Yeah, because I want to talk about how I don't think Penn is that important for it.
No.
But let's talk about, well, first... Arthur Penn, you mentioned that he is one of the key figures in New Hollywood, but
I was stretching that.
He's only the key figure in New Hollywood because of this movie, right?
This movie.
Like, he's made a couple other things, but no. I don't feel like... It's interesting that this is one of the movies that launches New Hollywood, which is so auteur-based, but I feel like he's not much of an auteur.
No. I don't know. He made Alice's Restaurant.
Yeah, I haven't seen Alice's
and
Restaurant, but I love the song.
You'd love the song. So just imagine, like, the movie version of the song.
Which, I can imagine it possibly being bad.
That song's pretty hippie-ish, though.
Yeah.
Do you know what I'm saying? And he made Little Big Man, which is a total new Hollywood movie.
Okay.
We will no doubt talk about that at some point.
I don't really feel his influence behind this film. I mean, there's some great editing, but maybe we should credit the editor,
D.D.
Allen, for the editing.
Yes, perhaps a bigger figure in some ways.
Yeah, so I guess I'm maybe it's because I haven't seen any of... Arthur Penn's other stuff, but I just don't really feel him behind this movie. And in fact, like, Pauline Kael in her long essay talks about how, like, Arthur Penn's kind of, like, working against the script in a lot of ways. Like, yes. he makes things a little too sugar-coated. Yeah. He, for example, Clyde was written as bisexual in the script, and originally written that Bonnie, Clyde, and CW all had a three-way relationship.
I know.
And they were like, nah, let's not. Like, Penn didn't want it like that. He thought that it would make the characters too unlikable, or, you know, they would just be written off as sexual deviants. And Warren Beatty also was like, I don't want to be portrayed that way. That's, and they were also worried it wouldn't be up to production code.
Well, that's supposedly true. There's another story where, you know, Beatty gets the script and he begins reading it and he calls Benton and Newman and he's like, I have to do this part. And they're like, how far did you get in the script yet? And he's like, six pages in. And they're like, call me when you get to page whatever, where the threesome happens with the other guy. And so then they like wait a little bit and he called back and he's like, okay, I know what you mean, but I still want to do the movie. So apparently Beatty still was down.
Tell us about Beatty.
Okay.
Yeah. Right. He's a controversial figure, right? Kind of an asshole. Isn't he?
Maybe if you're a woman who wanted him to be your boyfriend or something. Kind of exacting. Yeah, I mean, look, this is a man who, in many ways, single-handedly created the idea of an actor being a producer. Okay? This is a thing we have all the time now. You know, Brad Pitt, George Clooney, anybody does this. You know, like, almost any star, you know, if you're Sandra Bullock and you're shopping a script around that you want to, you know, get done, and you're a producer, like, you get to say, and of course we have me, like, in order to sell the movie and stuff. And, you know, that really helps. But this was just, like, that was not something that was being done. I mean, they're still shaping the concept of a director and, you know, what everybody's role in modern cinema is going to be coming out of the old studio system, right? So Beatty, he is a product of the late 50s. You know, he's a handsome leading man. He has a performance in a film called Splendor in the Grass with Natalie Wood, a movie that I really love. That, you know, I think is super underseen, that I would totally love to watch, but, you know, is very much a little old-fashioned. You know, it comes out in 1960, 61. He does a couple of other movies. He was in the earlier Arthur Penn film, Mickey One, which was very French New Wave influenced, and I haven't seen this film. But, so, basically he is a super handsome actor who's not considered a great actor and is considered very picky. Like, he's turning down all these roles. He's not made a real hit or anything, you know what I mean? So, like, he's not somebody that anybody is, like, desperate to work with or for. So it's not like he has a lot of cachet that he's, you know, expending or whatever. But he somehow manages to convince people that he is a kind of an artist. Or if he doesn't convince them that he's an artist, he convinces them that he is a relentless person who will not stop calling you and bugging you until you just give him what he wants. There's this famous story of him getting down on his knees in Jack Warner, the head of Warner Brothers studio, and kissing his feet, begging him to do this. And Warner's like, what the hell? Just get away from me and stuff. Many people have denied that this story happens, but it's a very famous story. That is the Beatty thing. He became relentlessly, you know, wanting to be the master of his own destiny as an actor, which is not something that typically is available to any actor. Mm. You're sort of usually at the mercy of somebody else. And Beatty became somebody who was worth waiting for him to choose a project. You know, he did not make himself oversaturated in the culture. He was just a presence that was known as a tastemaker. And, you know, he was known as an actor who wasn't, you know, he wasn't Marlon Brando, but he just kind of made interesting choices as far as material goes, knew what he worked best in, and gained a huge amount of commercial power because he usually made hits.
He's so compelling to watch, and he does seem to have a good sense about what to go with. Like,
I think he's given a number of good performances, too.
I will always remember the opening scene of that one movie.
Shampoo?
No, the one considered a terrible movie.
Oh, Ishtar. Yes! Yeah. No, oh my god, no. I mean, he's great. Yeah, he's so good in that. He's so funny.
Yeah. In that movie.
And in this movie, he's pretty hot.
So hot.
I have to say, his body.
Yeah.
Is great for a person in the 60s.
He's not really my type.
Right.
But he is very hot in this. The Warner Brothers didn't really support Beatty's vision. Like, Beatty wanted to be in black and white originally.
Which was wrong.
Like, no, yeah, it would have been bad in black and white. That just would have been too much of like a, oh, let's do the European artsy thing, you know?
Or an old-fashioned gangster.
Yeah, that too, yeah.
Yeah, which Warner Brothers, by the way, that's what they do.
Like, well, they wanted to move away from that.
Exactly, right.
So that's why they weren't really fully behind this script. And so a lot of the senior management was hostile towards the film, and Warner Brothers didn't promote it for a general release. They only wanted it to have a limited regional release because they didn't think it would have that much commercial appeal. But then eventually, Beatty threatened to sue the company, so they gave it a general release, and it became a box office success.
Right, yeah. How are you going to argue with this person? He won't shut up, and then he turns out to be right.
Yeah.
I mean, it's, you know... A lot of it is luck, obviously, but at the same time, it's hard to deny that clearly he knows something. You know what I mean? Like he's got some kind of business sense.
I also think he must have good taste if he's going to Europe and being like, hey, Truffaut, what's going on?
Right, exactly. You know? Yeah,
like,
no.
He likes New Wave, or is at least aware of it enough to know what to be latching onto.
And look, a big part of Beatty, we got to talk about this, is maybe the most famous womanizer in the history of Hollywood. You know, it's just like every story with Beatty is like, I went over to his house and he's like, hi, and he's in a robe and like some insanely gorgeous actress comes out from the back and she's like, oh, hello, bye. And like slinks away awkwardly and it's like, call me. And he's like, sure, whatever. And something like this is the cliche about Beatty, you know? And he does depict this sort of like jet setter James Bond kind of thing that I'm sure was kind of probably very compelling to these nerdy directors who would, you know, come and see him and be just sort of in awe of the whole, you know, sphere that he is occupying.
Yeah.
I think that's part of the Beatty mystique.
Yeah, he's just electric.
He just, yeah, he's, women want him, men want to be him. It's, that's the thing.
So I had not seen this movie before.
Right, yes, I had.
It's a big hole in my film knowledge, and so I'm glad I finally saw it. I knew a lot about it already.
Yeah.
Obviously, I know the story of Bonnie and Clyde, but I also had read enough about New Hollywood to know what to expect from the film.
Some
like,
violence.
I knew the violence. I knew the ending was going to be, like, despite the violence throughout the movie, I knew the ending was going to be, like, oh man, that was some very sobering violence. But what I did not expect and did not know was the lack of sexual relationship between Bonnie and Clyde. And that was the thing that made the movie really compelling to me and really endearing, because it was just so, they're both so attractive. And so you think, okay, obviously they're going to be involved, but they're not. And even though he says like, oh, I'm not into men or anything, he's obviously coded as being gay or bisexual, but seems like just gay because he doesn't want to sleep with her.
Right.
And it's just so endearing that he has such a platonic love for Bonnie. Like, he wants her to stay with him the whole time. He doesn't want her to go away, even though he gives her an out. You know, he says, like, they don't know your name yet. You can leave if you want. But she says no, and he's so happy that she says that she'll stay, that he tries to sleep with her.
Yeah.
But, you know, he can't do it.
And that depiction of impotence is so real. It's like one of those things where you're watching a movie and you're like, are they really having sex? This is so real. Except it's like, are they really not having sex?
Right, yeah. That one scene felt so scandalous that they were showing her going down to give a blowjob. I don't know how common blowjobs were back then in movies. I don't think they were that common in the movies. So she's going down to give a blowjob, and that alone seems scandalous. But then he doesn't want it. And that makes it so much more scandalous. Like, oh, he's gay.
Yeah,
like,
right.
Wow. And it's like just kind of this awkward thing. But, and then he, you know, he gets a little frustrated and he's like, well, I told you I wasn't a lover.
Right. And he wants to want it, but it's not, he's not like angry at her or something like that. He's like,
he's like, this isn't me.
Yeah. I don't, you know.
And she pauses.
Right.
And then she smiles and shrugs.
Yeah. Right.
And then that
part
woman,
is so good. Yeah.
You love her too, because like he has this platonic love for her and she loves him. And but there is sexuality behind it, but she accepts him. She throws it in his face a little bit later when they get upset, but she accepts him throughout the whole thing.
And she immediately apologizes for that, and then he accepts her apology.
Yeah.
Like, that's what I'm saying. Like, they are very emotionally available to each other.
Yeah.
And that's what's so great.
I love that.
The other good thing is they're so committed to each other, and they really believe in each other.
Yeah.
Like, it is that thing of, like, you're great. And I know people probably tell you you're great, but they don't even really get how great you are.
Yeah.
And like, you deserve so much. And she's like, you're right, I do. And so do you. And he's like, yeah, you're right. Like, it's, they are depicted as extremely sympathetic.
Yeah.
It is one of the most sympathetic depictions of this kind of, I understand why it would be disturbing. Imagine a version of this now. You know, I could see people now, like, getting some version of bent out of shape over this much of a sympathetic portrayal of people who are presented as also truly evil.
Or yeah.
Truly immoral.
Kale says, and there's a quote from her in her article about this film, it is the absence of sadism. It is the violence without sadism that throws the audience off balance.
Yeah, they kill people, they feel bad about it, but at the same time it's like, had to be done, and this is the way the world works. We still deserve this life that we want, you know? Like, it's the Depression, everybody's scrapping, society is out to get poor people. We're not on the wrong side of anything. We only kill people who are trying to stop us from living. Nobody in this movie is crazy. The most sadistic character, in some ways, is the bounty hunter.
You mean the sheriff?
Hamer?
Who goes after him?
Right, yeah. He is very cruel to Blanche.
His family later, I think they sued the filmmakers because he didn't, that's not how it went down. Like, he didn't get caught and make a, you know, have to take a photo with them. So they thought they made him look like a doofus.
Yeah.
But, you know.
This movie is not particularly historically accurate.
No.
There's all sorts of stuff. Like, apparently, like, they use modern money in some of the bank robbery scenes.
Oh, that's funny.
And people are looking at it, they're like, that's just like, that's just money from now.
I mean, Faye Dunaway looks like she's in the 60s.
She does, right. And became a style icon instantly. Like, people started dressing like Bonnie Parker. Like, her depiction of Bonnie Parker in this thing. And, like, the banjo music, which is great, Scruggs and Flat, that is music that, and this is just kind of an interesting thing, that is music that didn't exist in this time period.
Oh, really?
That's, like, 15 years before that music was invented.
Oh.
Which is interesting. Yeah, no, bluegrass music started in, like, the late 40s.
Oh.
So, like, it had been around for, like, 15 years by the time this movie came out.
Huh.
And those guys who did the soundtrack had their first hit, like, 4 years before.
Hmm.
Like, their first, like, real mainstream hit with the Beverly Hillbillies themes. the Ballad of Jed Clampett or whatever. But, so, yeah. Banjo, the soundtrack is amazing.
Yeah, I mean, they play the same music the whole time.
They do.
But it's fine.
I'm a huge Earl Scruggs fan. So, you know, I have a taste for banjo music. I think that the movie in general gets a little repetitive.
Yeah, it does. I thought the climactic scene was happening when they're all in a field and when Buck gets injured.
Yes.
I thought that was going to be the big shootout at the end. But it wasn't, and it kept going. And then there's, like, more shootouts. So, yeah, I agree.
It's kind of the same thing over and over with Bonnie and Clyde. They can't have sex, but they love each other.
But they do at the end. How do you feel about that?
Well, I kind of like it.
I think I would have liked it if it felt more like he was having sex with her to express his appreciation for her, but that it wasn't actually, like, sexual attraction still. And it does feel a little too much. Maybe I'm just, like, being way too influenced by Pauline Kael's opinion of this. She thinks that part doesn't quite work, and the audiences are too sophisticated for the dramatic uplift of triumph over impotence. And then it's a little too, like, putting a bow on it. Like, oh, they've had sex, and he did a great job.
I know, yeah, that's funny. You know, I see that. That's an interesting point. I mean, maybe I'm just, like, looking for what meaning it is trying to say, because they have sex after she writes a poem about them.
A poem that Bonnie really did write.
Yes.
I loved the poem. I thought it was really cute.
It was very sweet. And what turns him on is
himself.
He's like, you finally helped me love myself. You actually see me.
Mm.
You know?
Yeah.
And now, the movie had never really made me think that they weren't seeing each other. So it's a little bit unearned in that sense. And I see that it's a little cheap.
Yeah.
But my problem with the movie would more just be, like, few too many bank robberies, few too many evasions of the cops.
I actually don't think there were that many bank robberies.
Yeah, maybe it could be some more bank robberies.
Different types of bank robberies.
I love the one where they are super efficient. They finally figured out how to do it cleanly. And everybody's, like, really impressed with just how orderly they're doing it, and they got the getaway car waiting.
Is that the one where they then do edits? There's editing in between the chase scene and the people who were involved in the bank robbery.
That's the most new wave, the most French new wavy part, yeah. I think.
I liked that a lot.
I did too. Yeah. That was one of my my favorite
like
touches.
The farmer being like, he did right by me, left me my money. You
right. Know? And then, cool. And before he finishes the sentence, like it's, you know, like, yeah, it's very stylized. And so let's get into that. Like this sort of like, the sort of larger social implications of, you know, the Robin Hood thing of Bonnie and Clyde, right?
Yeah, they are folk heroes. So one thing about the movie is they are given excuses for their behavior, but it's not really like in the sense that like they are shown to they go to this house.
Yeah.
And there's the farmer there. And the farmer's like, go right on ahead. The bank sees this house. We have to leave. Basically, like, I don't give a shit, you know?
Yeah,
and then Clyde shoots the sign that says property of the bank. And then that's when they say, we rob banks.
For the first time.
Yeah.
Yes.
And it's like, the farmer obviously isn't going to like banks. So he's like, we're fighting for you guys.
Right.
But Clyde was already a petty thief.
Right.
Before this. So it's not...
I don't think they robbed banks before that. I think they just robbed a general store.
Yeah, but he's introduced as
armed robbery.
Yeah, but I'm just saying, like, it's not like he wasn't already a criminal.
No, but not robbing banks.
Sure.
Like, that gives him the idea of, like, this is the way we
can... Bank robbing,
because they'd already had the run-in with somebody who tried to hurt him at that point.
He really didn't want to have to hurt anybody, and he was kind of upset at the guy trying to hurt him.
Yes.
Like, I'm not trying to hurt anybody. Why are you trying to hurt me?
Right.
But it's just, like, it gives them a reason for being this Robin Hood character.
Yes.
But also, like, it's not painting it as if they are the most morally correct people. That's not the real reason. They're doing it because it's fun and exciting.
Yes. They're looking for something out of life.
Bonnie, the first shot of her is lying in bed, banging her hand against the bars of her bed frame,
yes,
as if she's trapped in a prison. So she just like wants to escape. So it's not like they are these perfectly morally justified characters.
No.
But they are fighting for they're on the people's side because they're poor.
Well, it's sort of funny because the guy's reaction to we rob banks, I feel like, is very like, all right.
Yeah, he's like, not like, yeah.
Right. He's not like, yeah, I love you, Bonnie and Clyde. Yeah. Right. And then, like, when they go to the Hooverville, the little tent city with the poor people around a campfire, they're suspicious at first, and then very intrigued that it's Bonnie and Clyde.
Yeah.
But they don't seem to love them.
Everywhere they go, people want to take pictures with them, but they keep getting found out by the cops that they're staying at a given place, so they keep getting turned in, obviously.
This was one of the first times in films that squibs were used.
Tell us what squibs are.
So squibs are, you know, you've seen a movie, somebody gets shot and a bit of blood explodes out of them. And if they get shot a bunch of times, they look like they are sort of having various eruptions all over their body and it looks really cool. Before this, you'd see a movie and somebody would get shot and they'd violently clutch their chest and fall over, but you wouldn't really see the blood or any hole or any... Maybe they didn't even really move back that far. They would just kind of get shot and fall. This is like what it looks like to get shot.
There are little explosions happening in the squib.
And they're getting shot hundreds of times. Like, they're getting riddled with bullets. So there's a part where Clyde's body's on the ground and they're just like, it's like a kid with a video game. Just you can't stop shooting a dead body.
Yeah.
And it's disturbing. I'm sure
it is disturbing.
Incredibly disturbing at the time. And even more disturbing is just, they get shot to shit and then the end.
Right. That's it.
No resolution. Yeah. Like, I mean, no falling action or whatever. It's just like, well.
An obvious contrast to the rest of the movie where there's violence throughout, but then they're in these heavy scrapes and then that banjo music plays and they get out of it. But this time there's no banjo music coming.
Yeah, that's a great point.
It's just the end.
Yeah.
There's silence. And I knew that the ending was going to be very sobering violence. And it still came across that way, even though I knew to expect that.
Yeah.
It still pulled off that effect of like, oh shit.
Yeah.
Like that, the way she's hanging out of the car.
I know, you're really scared for the actress, almost, to some degree. Like, I'm scared that she's gonna fall on her neck and break it or something like that. Because she's hanging out of her car with like her head it's hard to describe, but yeah. Sorry for me.
It was just, it's disturbing. Yeah, it is. And so many bullet holes, and their bodies are just like bouncing back and forth with the gun. It's, yeah, it was a lot. And you don't even see the gunmen.
That's true.
They come out of the bushes later, so it's just
this. A little Vietnam-y.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
They're hiding in the bushes and just sniping them and stuff.
Yeah. As I said before in the previous episode, I love downer endings like that where somebody gets, not necessarily a downer ending.
Is it a downer,
like,
yeah.
But an ending where it's that kind of like taking the wind out of the happy sails that maybe the rest of the movie portrayed. I wouldn't say that the movie's happy at all. Actually, I found the movie very much a downer.
Yeah, tell me, so what did you think of the movie? Can you just give it? Because I'm also wondering what I thought of it. Yeah, so.
I thought it was a good movie.
Yeah.
But yeah, it depressed me.
Depressed you?
Yeah. Not even by the end. It was like, it was right from the very beginning. In the same way that Badlands depresses me. Mm. It's like small town, small lives, even though their lives get so big. It's just, I don't know, it just made me sad. And Pauline Kael said she had this experience when she first watched it, that she was sitting next to this woman who kept saying to her friends, like, oh, it's a comedy, don't worry. And then eventually the woman stopped saying that.
Right.
But she said it a little too far into the movie, that the woman was just trying to like convince herself, like, it's going to be a comedy, but it's not a comedy.
It often is, though. Gene Wilder is hilarious.
Oh, he's so funny.
Gene Hackman is also hilarious in it.
But
the opening sequence is quite funny.
It's
like,
sad, though. No, I didn't find the opening sequence funny.
Yeah, I don't know. I think this is a movie that is, it holds up.
It does. I mean, this is my first time seeing it, but.
I mean, yeah, I mean, I don't, it doesn't feel dated.
Yeah.
It's not, I mean, it's clear that we have to sort of explain how disturbing people found it, because it would be weird to find it that disturbing, I think, on the deep level that, like, Bosley Crowther did. You know, where like
right, because
we've
so
seen
influential.
Yes, we have seen. Yeah,
movies are so different now. There's so much violence in
right,
movies now.
Right. So you know, it's like the idea of seeing like, just imagine if like a movie like spent 5 minutes showing a person's head getting sawed off or something like that. Like now, just like imagine just like the most violent torture porn. You know, like I don't want to see it. Right. You know.
Yeah.
I think that it's a movie that has so many good elements to it. That you kind of can't deny it. Like, it's
yeah,
just so many...
For sure.
Endless great actors. The set pieces all work. There's nothing about the movie that doesn't work.
Yeah.
Is it a movie that I would ever tell anybody is, like, one of my favorite movies? No. Is it a movie that I would watch regularly just to see what else I can glean from it? No, I feel like I've pretty much gleaned
yeah,
it. I mean, I would say I think it's a little more fun than you do.
I think there's something about it that I am particularly sensitive to. And there's a certain kind of movie that depresses me.
Right. Well, yeah, you don't like grodiness. You don't like trashy.
Grimy,
you know, poor, yeah, shitty houses and
dust,
stuff like that.
And,
dust,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
You're not much of a road movie.
Yeah, not really. Not a road movie.
I love these back roads. I love thinking about the back roads driving from Missouri to Oklahoma some reason. I don't know. You know,
it's like, fun watching a car chase scene on a back road where like they're not going that fast and they're just going over these bumps. Like,
no, and it's like there's no interstate highway system. Like, how hard could they be to find? Like, what are they driving through the woods or something like that? Like, you know where they went. Like, they're on the one road that exists. Like, come on. I mean, I guess you can't radio people as fast or whatever, and there's like strict jurisdictional things,
but the police were always finding them.
The police were
so
always
clearly
finding them.
Like, you know, they were always found throughout the movie. I don't know.
Well, I wonder in real life if like there was less
run-ins,
cops trying to find them.
Yeah.
Like if there were like just like a lot of like maybe small town sheriffs who were just like, what am I supposed to do? You know, like that kind of thing or something like that. I don't know. We didn't research the real Clyde Barrow and Bonnie Parker. But, you know, that also wasn't really important to Benton and Newman. They'd just sort of grown up in the Midwest. You hear about Bonnie and Clyde, and they were these Esquire writers, and they wanted to write a movie, and they were just, like, thinking about Bonnie and Clyde, but they really wanted to talk about other things. So, you know, realism was not a very important factor. I don't know if I... Yeah, you find it depressing, but I don't know if I think the movie really hits me on a particularly emotional level. I find it a pretty intellectual exercise.
Mm.
I think it's a movie where I'm thinking a lot about society. And this is kind of similar to things like The Godfather for me and stuff like that, where like what interests me is not the interpersonal relationships of the characters, but I feel like I'm, much like I suspect a lot of the directors and writers, getting very cerebral about it and sucked into the thinking about what this meant to young people in the 60s, which is, you know, a period that I find interesting in and of itself.
Yeah. I agree, going back to you, just, you know, the way you think it is a very good movie, undeniable. You're not going to rewatch it a lot. But yeah, I think that it fits the hype.
Absolutely.
It launches New Hollywood, and it deserves to be that starting movie.
Yeah, somebody's saying like, yeah, Bonnie and Clyde, it's not that great or whatever. It's like, what the fuck are you talking about? Yeah. It's good. Yeah. It's a good movie. It's a cool movie. It's an interesting movie.
It's entertaining.
It's entertaining and kind of deep.
Yeah,
you know, it's not shallow.
Yeah.
But it's at its heart, it's, you know, it's a movie about criminals who
are hot.
Who are hot and just kind of do the same thing over and over again. Yeah. Like that, you know, like it's...
But they do it with family.
They do it with family and an increasing sense of dread and you know, existential, what is my place in the world, overtakes them.
Yeah.
But...
I think I like, empathize a lot with Bonnie's character.
She's the best character.
The way that she gets annoyed at...
Blanche.
What's her face? Blanche and... You know, but she's stuck with Blanche. Like, I just felt that on such a visceral level of
that's
like,
true.
Oh, she's just gotta like hang out with Blanche all the time.
Yeah, right.
Like, I felt bad for her. Real life Blanche was still alive when the movie came out.
Oh, yeah?
And initially, she approved the script. She's like, yeah, sure. This sounds good. But then after she saw the movie, she complained that...
she was cuter than Estelle Parsons.
I mean...
Right?
I don't think it was that... In particular, but...
Estelle Parsons, by the way, who is amazing in general.
And she's the only one who won...
She won her Academy Award for this.
For Best Supporting Actor. And
Amazing in general. She's pretty good in this.
I think Gene Hackman should have won.
I agree.
The movie got nominated for almost everything.
Yes.
But Estelle Parsons was the only one who won for this movie.
Estelle Parsons is a legendary theater actor. I would give my... Well, I wouldn't give my left nut, but, you know, I would pay a lot of money to have gone to see her in August Osage County, in which she plays Violet, the matriarch. I've seen clips from it, and oh my God, she's so good. I mean, imagine just like Meryl Streep's in the movie version, and you're like... Meryl Streep fucking sucks compared to this person, like, in this role. It wasn't exactly Meryl's fault. That movie was flawed in general. But Estelle Parsons' amazing career. This kind of the height of her film career, though.
I mean
she was nominated for a couple... She did a couple other things. She was nominated after this. Mm. But, you know, perhaps more famous for her television work and Roseanne and in the theater, perhaps most importantly. Mm. But
yeah, so apparently Blanche... She complained that the film made me look like a screaming horse's ass.
Yeah, no, right. It makes her. She's the dilemma to some degree.
I don't like watching her in the movie because she's annoying, and I don't like the way she screams. And it's like, I just don't want to be stuck. I wouldn't want to be stuck with that annoying. Like some people get under my skin, and I don't want
to
be around them.
It's really amazing to watch because Elena is an incredibly sweet and nice person and very empathetic in general. But yeah. When the right person is around you, and it's not even like they're evil or something like that. It's just you just hate them, and
there's a
slightly
a certain
annoying
brand of annoying. No, it's not slightly annoying. There's just certain people who really annoy me, and it's only a couple people out there.
Yeah,
but yeah, then I become
you
a
cannot
total
control
bitch
your
to them.
Reaction.
Yeah,
to
I can't
them.
Help it. I'm sorry. I'm gonna be a bitch.
No, it's true. Like that one shot of like. Where Bonnie and Blanche are forced to drive the car together.
Yeah.
And just like Bonnie just has this look of Jesus fucking Christ while she's driving. I can't believe this. And Blanche is seated facing away from her in a car in the front seat. Like she's facing her body away from Bonnie. It's this amazing shot. But largely unknowns, you know, this is a series of star-making performances. Even Beatty and Dunaway emerged from this film as a completely different level of stardom that they had entered. Yeah, Dunaway was virtually unknown.
I think she said she got the role by the skin of her teeth.
Yeah.
They wanted other people like Jane Fonda, who I feel like has the same voice as Faye Dunaway in this movie.
Interesting. Yeah. Apparently, Bonnie was incredibly hard to cast. And they were thinking about Tuesday Weld, Jane Fonda, and Margaret, Sharon Tate. Imagine if Sharon Tate had been in this film.
I can't say I've seen that much Sharon Tate.
No, but just imagine if Bonnie and Clyde,
Oh, you mean just the symbolism of that?
Yeah, like, yeah. Would New Hollywood have been totally different? Do you know what I mean? Like if, I don't know, maybe that's
weird. Because she was murdered soon after?
Yeah, like, would this movie have just become impossible just to watch? Yeah, just like something that's like, I don't know.
When,
like,
was she murdered?
2 years later, after this movie came out.
Yeah, it would have been, that would have been weird.
But yeah, so very difficult to find. Nobody really believed that she could do it. She had done, you know, like maybe one other major performance called The Happening. Roger Ebert of the Chicago Sun-Times panned the performance, saying, quote, "She exhibits a real neat trick of resting her cheek on the back of her hand," which is a pretty sick burn. I mean, Ebert also, his review of Bonnie and Clyde and the acting of Beatty and Dunaway is like, they are both great, to my surprise, basically, more or less. Like, he's like, it seems they are major acting talents, I guess, was sort of the tone of his review. But, yeah, you know, so she's really no one. Beatty, a famous person who nobody really wants to put in a movie or see in a movie. Mm. You know, Hackman, Parsons, Wilder, Michael J. Pollard, these are theater actors that they're just put in a movie, and then these become major film stars over the course of the next 10 years. To have 4 or 5 star-making turns in a single movie, quite unusual.
Yeah.
I would say. You know, especially, considering it's the kind of movie that, I mean, these aren't even showy roles, really. Like, none of them are the showiest of acting roles.
Yeah.
Again, as we say, like, Gene Wilder comes off, he pops so much harder than anybody else really does.
Yeah. He pops fucking hard.
He's in a different universe.
He is.
Like,
he
than
is.
They are.
Yeah.
But yeah, so this movie, just like made so many careers and has remained a calling card.
Can we talk about, so like, what would you say is the biggest factors that make it so New Hollywood-y? I would say the main thing is just the violence.
Absolutely.
Like, that's the main thing. And the
Sensitivity of the lead characters with the violence, as
yeah,
well.
Like, yeah, and the unusual sexual relationship, or like I was just so surprised.
Yeah,
I was
frankness.
Expecting there to be sex, and it was the opposite, but it made it even more sexual in a way because they were talking about sex and yeah. not having it.
Yes, no, absolutely right. It's the realness in a weird yeah. way. It's the realism that everything is depicted with.
Yeah,
it's a very ecstatically made film, but you know, it's not a very showy aesthetic. Work like yeah. it's very much just trying to depict a harsh, grim reality.
Yeah, and it didn't accidentally become this type of film. Like, it was written by people who were trying to do a French New Wave thing.
They wanted,
but then they had an American director.
Yeah, what if we had? They wanted it to be in English, obviously. Like they weren't trying to make a foreign film, but they wanted to.
But they wanted foreign directors. They wanted Truffaut and Godard.
Well, Truffaut was about to make his first English language film, Fahrenheit 451.
Yeah, but still, like,
Right. What they wanted to do was bring this sensibility to America.
Yeah,
is what I'm saying. Like,
they did.
They yeah. absolutely single-handedly did. Like,
yeah.
they set out to do it. Benson yeah. and Newman. We're talking about the screenwriters.
Yeah,
they set out to do it, and they totally succeeded.
Yeah,
and it was a weird-sounding thing to want to do.
Yeah, I would love to know. There's a after they murder the first person.
Yes.
With the botched robbery where CW parks the car.
Yeah.
By the way, apparently that shot of the guy getting hit in the face, Kale says that's directly an homage to Battleship Potemkin. And I was okay, if
gotta
you say so.
Gotta rewatch that one. been a while for me.
I didn't follow too closely to Battleship Potemkin. My eyelids were drooping little bit.
We've watched it, at least. What do you want from us, okay? Yes. We've watched Battleship Potemkin. Sure, we didn't pay attention to it, but we watched it, okay?
I saw the staircase scene. I paid attention to that scene.
I remember those boys slapping backs and tumbling all over each other.
There was montage,
yeah.
you know? There were the people walking to work and the cows and yeah. to slaughter and shit.
Yeah, and I actually know what the Battleship Potemkin is in real life.
Well,
we're not going to get into it.
You. But I don't.
It doesn't matter.
But anyways, Kale yeah. definitely, you know, slipped into like total film nerd when she said that.
Yeah, that's great.
That's true. I was curious as to whether that actually is true, that it was trying to do the Battleship Potemkin thing.
I think a lot of Battlestar Potemkin's a much referenced work. Obviously, The Untouchables, I think, is a famous homage to it as well. But it seems like a lot of film people saw that movie.
So it could be.
Yeah.
But so I would love to know if in the so after that they're in a movie theater, and they are kind of cooling down, and Clyde is getting really mad at CW and stuff. In the background is Gold Diggers of 1933 playing.
Yeah.
A old Hollywood movie.
Yes, a pre-Hayes film.
Yeah.
Like, pre-Hayes Code.
Yeah.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so it's just, I'd love to know if that was written into the script, like whose decision that was, because it felt like saying, oh, this is old Hollywood.
Yeah.
And we're not doing that.
No, you're right. I mean, look, it's obviously very pointedly used. Like the fact that they are watching a movie. And this is written by people who think about the movies. I think there's no question that is what you're saying.
Yeah.
That is not something we're projecting onto it. Whether that was Benton and Newman or Beatty, who also is credited with working some on the script. Can't really say. But, you know, it's a fabulous piece of contrast.
Yeah.
And also just, I love watching Busby Berkeley anyways.
Yeah.
Just put it in any movie.
Yeah.
Just to have people watch it.
Yeah, we're Busby Berkeley fans. You especially.
Me especially, for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. Like, this is a movie about group dynamics, to some degree.
It was so charming, the scene where they convince C.W. Moss to join their group.
Beautiful.
I love that.
I think the movie's first act is its best.
Yeah.
To be honest. I love the opening sequence. And yeah, like the getting the gang together. And to me, yeah, the movie's tone becomes more downbeat once Gene Hackman and Estelle Parsons come in.
Yeah.
And are sort of pouring cold water on the magic that has been created by Bonnie and Clyde.
Yeah, because like I think Bonnie can feel like she still gets alone time with Clyde, even when CW is there.
Yes.
Like, there's that scene where she's, like, leaning over to see, you know, just, do you want to have sex right now? And Clyde's pretending to be asleep. And, like, CW is, like, in the next bed asleep.
Yeah.
And she's like, that's fine with me. You know, like, so she's still, she's
They're
okay.
meant to be in a three-way relationship.
Yeah, yeah. So she's, like, so that's fine with her. But then once Buck and Blanche join, it's, like, feeling a little crowded.
Yeah.
And they want to bring even more people along. They try to convince Gene Wilder and his girlfriend to join too.
Yeah.
They want to keep growing that group.
I think that would have been good. Like that would have been probably what that group needed.
Yeah.
Like
a little more
degree.
Wiggle room.
Yeah.
Like a little more distance between Bonnie and Blanche.
And they love how light they are until he brings up death, and then of course it's like, well, that's definitely impossible. Yeah.
Yeah. And then the group starts dissolving in the same order in which it formed.
Yes, correct.
So right. Then you lose Buck and Blanche, and then at the very end, CW, it's interesting, I guess CW kind of lets them go into the trap because he does truly believe that they can escape it.
Yes.
But it's weird that he doesn't warn them. I think a little bit of a plot hole there.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like I can understand being convinced that you're getting off with a lighter sentence if you go along with this trap. He still thinks they're going to escape, but he's not going to risk his life. He's not going to risk getting as much jail time as they're expected to get.
And he's also, like, not that intelligent of a character.
He's not that intelligent, but also, like, he seems to be rather impressionable and kind of blow with the wind.
Right, you know, that's what I mean. Like, you can easily be convinced by Bonnie and Clyde, but then later his dad.
His dad convinces him. Do you want to talk about his tattoo?
That was such a weird emphasis of the movie.
But again, I mean, that's so counterculturally. Counterculturally. It reminds me of Frankenfurter in Rocky. Being like, do you have any tattoos? Like that, you know what I mean? Like that kind of thing of like, are you a weirdo who's got a tattoo? You know, sort of thing. Like
it felt like a little too much of a nod to like current audience being like, you guys have tattoos, right? We're
useful. Well, they didn't, though.
When I was watching that, I was like, I don't know when tattoos started. Were tattoos around when Bonnie and Clyde happened?
It would still be incredible. Well, they were around, obviously, but it's only if you're a fugitive from the law are you the kind of person who gets a tattoo. Or like a sailor or something, you know what I mean? Just like a real, like, you're not a part of our mainstream society kind of thing, you know?
I think, so the tattoo thing, in the script, when he says that Bonnie likes it, that's supposed to be kind of a reference of, like, that they've all had sex.
Yeah.
You know?
That is vestigially in there. Do you want to talk about this? Would it have been better if that... Because I kind of... I love the impotence.
I don't like the impotence being explained by, like, oh, I'm straight, but just impotent. I would have liked it to be, like, I'm gay, and so I can't give that to you. Because he didn't seem like he even wanted to try, is the thing. It didn't feel like impotence from sexual desire, but not being able to go through with it. It seemed right. like he just genuinely wasn't into
no her. Interest in sex.
Yeah.
Or just sex. I think he was into her.
He was into her as a
down
person.
To kiss her.
Maybe barely.
Maybe not even. You're right.
He didn't even kiss her until after his first run-in with that butcher.
Yeah.
And he was scared. Like, she, like, hops on him and starts making out with him after their first burglary. And when you're watching that, you're like, okay, this is, like, sexually charged movie. But then he pushes her away and he's like, no, I'm not a lover boy.
Yeah, you know? I ain't no lover boy.
Yeah, so he doesn't even seem interested. So it doesn't seem like an impotence type of thing to me. It seems like he's just not sexually interested in her.
But, like, I like the idea of what he said. Like, more than the idea of, like, he's just secretly gay. I like the idea of him being, like, he's almost like, there's that scene in Sid and Nancy when Johnny Rotten's like, sex is boring. You gotta try heroin. Why are you, you know, it's just like, he's like, you can have sex with anybody.
Yeah.
You're not gonna be Bonnie and Clyde with anybody.
Right, I like that too.
Okay,
like
it's like, sex is whatever, people, okay? Yeah. I'm after something, a greater truth, you know?
I mean, he could be Ace.
Yeah, he could be Ace. Yeah, exactly. You know, like, something like that.
And I do see the point, the concern about them being sexual deviants.
Exactly.
Like, I really hate how, in anime, for example, I hate if there's, like, this sweet female character who's very innocent, and then suddenly it turns out she's, like, betraying them.
Yeah.
And she suddenly becomes super sexual, and that's the only way to have a sexual female, is that she's also, like, a violent person. So, like, the connection between violence and criminality and sexual deviance is a thing that people should stay away from in films. Like, it's not good to depict, you know, sexual deviance with being a bad person.
Right. Now, again, they're walking the line in this movie of they're not really depicted as bad people.
Right, right.
So, you know, you could have maybe played it in a way that was like, they're just outside of your rules of society, man.
Yeah.
And they don't care about your stupid prohibitions against two men loving each other. It's perfectly normal and natural, and we should all be able to, you know.
Right.
If they were able to depict that, it could have been, honestly, one of my favorite movies ever.
Yeah.
Maybe. Like, I could see a version of that that I love in a deeper way.
Yeah.
You know?
And it was certainly hinted at throughout the movie. So you still had elements of that in the movie.
Right.
But yeah, they could have gone a little more into it. But CW wasn't attractive.
No.
He was way less attractive than those two. So I guess maybe there's a believability factor with that.
Yeah.
Maybe they should have gotten a little more of an attractive actor if they wanted to sell that a bit more.
Yeah.
But he was very charming.
He was very charming. And right, like, I also just, like, I do love that they are so much more attractive than anybody else in the movie.
Yeah.
Like, they are so clearly, they're movie stars, right? It's like they walk in and your eye moves towards them.
But that's also, I mean, I don't know that much about the history of Bonnie and Clyde in real life, but wasn't that also part of the appeal of Bonnie and Clyde?
Right.
Is that they were just hot?
Yeah, well, and boy and girl in love, Robin Banks, you know, I think it's like, aw. Kind of, I think there's like this element of like, they're in a gang because they just want to hang out with each other. Kind of to a certain degree, you know, like, they want to work together, you know? And then that's true. It's a depiction of, it's kind of like a work wife sort of thing. Like, almost, you know what I mean? It's like, it's sort of like Liz and Jack at 30 Rock or something. I don't know. You know, but yeah, it's people who want to start a business together and want to be, Bonnie wants to be in the Clyde Barrow business and Clyde wants to be in the Bonnie Parker business.
Yeah.
Well, this is a much discussed film. Many people have said many things about it. Some of them we have repeated. I am getting to the end of my ideas that I have about Bonnie and Clyde, the things that I have to say about Bonnie and Clyde.
Basically, although it's much discussed,
yes,
we might discuss it less than we discuss other movies.
Yeah, and like a lot of what there is to talk about Bonnie and Clyde is with the making of it and with the reception of it, I think.
Yeah, which I think we covered succinctly.
We have covered it succinctly, and people know the story of the reception of Bonnie and Clyde. It's amazing. A reviewer retracted his original review. How cool is that? That's like when Gravity's Rainbow was clearly supposed to win the Pulitzer Prize, but just one person couldn't give it to him because it was too gross, so they just didn't give the Pulitzer that year. You know, it's like you broke the system.
Yeah.
This is a truly a breaking the system movie.
It is.
It broke the system wide open.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. And opened it up for a whole slew of other amazing movies.
Yes.
That we are so excited to talk about.
Yes.
We will talk about in the next episode, The Graduate, came out the same year. That also contributed to New Hollywood launching off. And then, yeah, lots of fun stuff in the future.
All right, that's our show. Please remember to rate, review, and subscribe. Check us out on social media. Thank you to The Illuminator for our artwork. And remember, guys, we're a new podcast, so if you could leave a comment or just a like, that would really help us out. Thank you. Bye. Marlon Brando, Ellen Burstyn, Robert Evans, and Shelley Duvall. Sad endings, 'cause of Watergate.